Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, March 30th, 2023. Long-awaited construction begins on Presidio International Bridge by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio. Last week, Presidio County Judge Joe Portillo led a tour of the newly active construction site on the Presidio International Bridge. Precincts 1 and 4 Commissioners Brenda Silver Bentley and David Beebe tagged along to see crews hard at work finishing a project that has stalled on and off for 5 years. In 2017, the Trump administration signed off on a project authorizing construction on the bridge. Both countries planned to build a two-lane bridge parallel to the existing bridge in the hopes of cutting down on customs wait times and to expanding the bridge's business potential. The Mexican government finished its half of the project in 2020 after a brief pause due to COVID. Construction on the American side was also stalled during this time, but never picked back up in earnest. Traffic on the bridge continued to grow during these years, but both cargo and private vehicles experienced significant, frustrating delays. Local officials were then subjected to a confusing stream of conflicting information. First, they were told that the delay was thanks to TxDOT, who owns the bridge. TxDOT representatives then told the city that they were waiting on Governor Abbott's office, then later pinned the blame on Mexican officials. After a year and a half of promises that bridge construction would start within a few months, construction has actually begun. A crew from Earth Builders out of Hearst started staging materials a few weeks ago and began working in earnest last Monday, with an expected completion date of September 5th. Commissioner Brenda Silva Bentley, whose precinct includes a slice of Marfa, Shafter, and Presidio, was excited to see that progress was being made. "It just feels good to know that they're working on it again. It seems like it's been going on forever," she said. Earlier this month, County Judge Joe Portillo petitioned both Presidio City Council and Presidio County Commissioners Court about the idea of turning the new bridge into its own independent port authority. The Presidio Ojinaga Bridge is the only international crossing owned by TxDOT. With more independence, Portillo hoped that the bridge could make its own monies so that necessary improvements could be initiated in-house. "We have a lot of visitors, and we welcome them, but they do have an impact," Judge Portillo said at a Presidio City Council meeting on March 7th. "It's only fair for them to help us offset some of the costs so that everybody pays a fair share." Bentley supported the proposal with a few caveats. The new Port Authority would have the ability to charge tolls. Folks hoping to cross back into the United States pay a small toll, but no tolls are charged leaving the United States. "I don't want to put people in a predicament where they can't afford to go across and come back," she said. Ultimately, the commissioners were hopeful that the reinitiated construction signaled a bright future for the bridge, a future where crossing between Presidio and Ojinaga was hassle-free. "I'd like to see it become a place that people like," said Precinct 4 Commissioner David Beebe. "I'd like to see it where some days you don't have to wait 2 or more hours to cross. There's just no need for that." Copyright Kevin Greenblatt, 2023. For centuries, spring water near Balmoray has been channeled through a canal system to help irrigate crops, provide wetland habitats for migratory birds, and more. Environmental Defense Fund advocates for the preservation of San Solomon Springs with new story map by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL, at BigBenSentinel.com. Balmoray, an online story map over a year in the making, Water in the Texas Desert, the story of the San Solomon Springs system, was recently published by Environmental Defense Fund, EDF, an international nonprofit organization with a program dedicated to Texas water issues. The multimedia story map combines video footage, audio interviews with locals and scientists, landscape photography, illustrations of flora and fauna, maps, and more to tell the story of the understudied San Solomon Springs system. It chronicles the history of the springs' various human uses over time, beginning with Native Americans who harnessed the water to raise crops, and concluding with today's Balmoray State Park, the largest spring-fed pool in the world, which sees more than 200,000 visitors per year. I live in an oasis in the desert. I love this water, taking my kids to swim in it and to fish in the lake, said Balmoray resident Angel Maxwell in the story map. This water belongs to all of us. I don't know how much water is here. We think it's coming from hundreds of miles away. We don't know for sure, but we need to know. Dan Muller, Senior Manager of Climate Resilient Water Systems with EDF, who is based in Austin and led the project, said in addition to highlighting the vital role the springs play in the lives of area residents like Maxwell, the project stresses the need for further research and better understand the springs' water sources in order to make sure they keep flowing. Protecting the springs means protecting and understanding the groundwater flow and the complete spring shed, said Muller. Where does this flow come from? In total, the San Solomon Springs system contains six springs. The largest is San Solomon, which fills the state park pool at a rate of 11,000 gallons per minute. Another, nearby Phantom Springs, which is located on private property, has stopped flowing except for during heavy rainfall. Muller said the flow of San Solomon Springs, which is monitored by the United States Geological Survey, USGS, has declined over the years, like many springs across Texas, due to drought, overpumping, and other environmental factors. To protect that spring, you need to work in advance of the spring no longer flowing, said Muller. If a spring stops flowing, now you're too late. Now you're working backwards and trying to bring a spring back to life. That was the fate of Comanche Springs in nearby Fort Stockton, which is presented as a cautionary tale in the story map. The springs once supported the town's tourism, flowing at a rate of 30,000 gallons a day in the early 1900s, about twice the flow of San Solomon Spring today, but went dry in the 1960s due to pumping demands and hasn't returned. With looking at what has happened with Comanche Springs historically, you then go to the iconic San Solomon Springs, which is still flowing and flowing at a significant flow rate, but yet there's not enough known about its spring shed to give both landowners and groundwater managers the tools and information to really protect those springs, said Muller. Part of what makes San Solomon Springs system difficult to understand is that the hydrogeology, or ways the water moves underground, is complex in the area, said Muller. Research conducted by Rebecca Nunu, a groundwater hydrologist with the Southwest Research Institute, found that source areas to all six springs were generally located west and northwest, including in Culberson County, 50 miles away, and further research was needed in that area. Muller said a current research objective is to determine the boundaries of the spring shed. A preliminary dotted map included in the story map shows land areas scientists would like to gain further access to. Land along I-10 West towards Van Horn including parts of Jeff Davis, Culberson, and Reeves counties. Mueller said scientists want to help landowners understand how and where spring sheds might be occurring on their property. Really, it's to their interests also to sustainably manage the groundwater. That's part of the value of their land, said Mueller. Another complicating factor of the San Solomon Springs system is that while its boundaries are not entirely understood, it is known to be expansive, meaning it overlaps multiple groundwater conservation districts and management areas. Local governmental entities that can make water management decisions. You've got jurisdictions overlapping each other, and how do they work together, said Mueller. Well, step one is to understand how much they are overlapping, and we don't know that yet. Greg Perrin, Reeves County Groundwater Conservation District General Manager, who was interviewed for the story map, said because the GCD was established in 2015, it was a young entity, still working to register pre-existing wells and build its program. However, one of the GCD's goals is to sustainably manage its aquifers, despite heavy oil and gas industry growth in the area. Science is the way to go in all of this. We have to look at what we're doing, what's happening to the aquifers, said Perrin. There's not much potable water here, but it's fairly decent for irrigation, and apparently is pretty good for going into drilling and exploration. It's very good for swimming, and it raises a few fish, too. Mueller said there's examples across the state of GCDs making proactive groundwater management decisions when armed with the right scientific data. The Hayes Trinity Groundwater Conservation District, for example, has plans in place to protect the flow of Jacobs Well Spring, which is located entirely within their district. If flow decreases, as it has currently with the spring going dry for the fourth time in recorded history, they take action. GCDs issue well drilling permits and might, for example, assess depths and locations of new wells and to help protect spring flows. For Solomon Springs, that's exactly what you would need, said Mueller. Only now you've got a much larger geographic area, and you've got multiple groundwater conservation districts that need to work together. EDF recently released a report on what it called Texas' flawed groundwater planning process, recommending state legislators funnel more adequate funding towards data collection and additional resources to local GCDs to help them set and attain sustainable groundwater goals. The inclusion of Texas Parks and Wildlife, Shield Ayers Foundation, and Nature Conservancy representatives, as well as longtime Balmoray locals such as David Smith, the owner of the 11 Inn, and Ellen Weinacht, who started a wetland in the area, was meant to show how many people are working together and are invested in seeing the springs conserved, said Mueller. It's really a local issue, and it's really the way ahead. The local collaboration of landowners, stakeholders, and groundwater managers, along with the researchers, said Mueller. Nita Ryan, owner of the Toya Vale Desert Oasis and Funky Little Dive Shop, who was also featured in the Story Map project and spoke previously with the Big Bend Sentinel about her concerns over the oil and gas industry boom negatively impacting the springs, said the springs are the life force of the town. We're dependent on those springs to survive, said Brian. San Solomon Springs creates a unique ecosystem. Here we are in the desert, so it's such a valuable resource of life to the desert. And without these springs, this would just be a dust bowl. To view the interactive story map, visit https://arcg.is/1Q51S5. Copyright Kevin Greenblatt, 2023. Balmoray resident, construction worker, and father Angel Maxwell was interviewed for the Environmental Defense Fund's online story map. Again, copyright Kevin Greenblatt, 2023. A custom map created for the EDF story map shows the locations of all six springs in the San Solomon Springs system.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March 30th, 2023. Teacher salary to increase at FSISD by Nathan Hewer. In June 2022, the Fort Stockton Independent School District Board and Superintendent Dr. Zamora set into motion a new zone pay scale with hopes of recruiting and retaining the most talented educators in the state. The pay scale addition gave fully certified zero-year teachers an opportunity to make $72,500, a significant increase within the district for those who meet the zone pay scale criteria. If they meet the criteria and expectations of those zones, the schedule is designed to retain and recruit the most talented individuals out there, Zamora said. On March 28th, the board approved a salary increase for fully certified zero-year teachers to $75,000. The approval allows first-year educators the potential to earn $75,000, including stipends, if they are approved for the zone pay scale. Zamora noted the increase had the potential to be higher and was pending on laws approved during the year's state legislative session. We're being conservative right now because we don't know what our state lawmakers are going to do. But what we're talking about right now is at a minimum, improving the ISD teacher salary scale, which is for fully certified teachers that are in the general area, not some. For teachers that do not qualify for zone, starting pay will be increased from $52,000 to $55,000. The second-year superintendent at the Fort Stockton ISD explained that since the implementation of the new pay system a year ago, the number of educators applying to the teachers has skyrocketed. The number of resumes we get right now are probably upward of the district's history. Ember forwards them every time they get filled out on the Quick app to all the cabinet and principals that are putting in. Talking to one of the principals the other day, they said it sure is nice to have a choice of applications versus having to find someone. The school district's laptop lease for teachers will soon expire, and with the technology bond funds approved during last May's election, the school board approved the purchase of new high-end laptops at their regular board meeting on March 27th. Zamora made the recommendation based on the principle of saving money from not paying interest and the buyout price given at the vendor by the vendor when the lease expires. With a lease, there is interest involved, and one of the reasons why you do that is because you can spread the cost of the money over the course of that three-year lease. The problem with that is at the end, there's a buyout price. It was going to cost us approximately $300 per laptop for us to keep the laptops that our staff currently has. The purchase of 255 Lenovo laptops with a three-year service agreement warranty will cost the district $273,000. Roy Alvarado, superintendent of CTE, stated that Thursday's meeting that the laptops were a significant upgrade and could last 3 to 4 years. These are very good laptops. They do have some enhancements, better processors. Performance-wise, they're better than what we currently have. Zamora added that the purchase of the laptops would be a wise investment due to the projected longevity of the devices. A three-year replacement on a laptop that is upper end is ambitious. It's not unusual for some places to push it to 5 years. There's nothing that says this isn't something that they can eventually take home and then have a new one at work. It also is not to say that we can't wipe them clean and auction them off. In addition to the laptop upgrades, the school board approved bids for a new high school track, the resurfacing of the school football field, and new LED lights at middle school. The new lighting at the middle school football field will be completed by Musco Sports Lighting for $602,000. Athletic Director Jeremy Hickman said at Monday's meeting that he was able to save $50,000 by going with Musco. Hickman later explained that the turfing of the football field will possibly be completed down the road if bond funds remain after the construction of a new field house and necessary stadium renovations. As Zamora said, we want to make sure we have the money to keep the to meet the obligations and promises we made. We want to make sure that we do the field house right. With inflation, we're holding off on turfing the middle school right now. The new high school track will be blue with gray exchange zones and feature an eighth lane as compared to seven lanes previously. Zamora said that since they approved the quotes before March 31st, the projects will be complete before the start of next school year. Hospital requests another $900,000. The Pecos County Commissioners heard another request for transfer of funds from Pecos County Hospital on March 27th in order to make the end-of-month payroll. The hospital requested $500,000 with an additional $400,000 that had previously been approved but not used earlier in March. This was the $400,000 that you asked for last meeting and you did not use. Is that correct? Judge Schuster said. Urita responded yes, adding that the hospital will be receiving intergovernmental transfer funds, but that won't arrive until March, which will be after payroll transfers. Urita said set low census numbers, the number of people in the hospital, is affecting the hospital and staff, is being reallocated as necessary. She also requested $20,000 in overtime pay and reported an accounts payable total of $586,000. As of Monday, the hospital had a bank balance of $1,030,000. Although we've had several checks clear the bank, we still have an outstanding amount of $221,000. The accounts payable is $556,000, so that leaves us with $222,000. Payroll will be due Thursday, so that was the reason we were asking for extra funds, because that would create a deficit of $302,000. We are, as I mentioned, getting an IGT payment of $337,000 at the beginning of the month of April. We have some debits that will also be due to the county and to the state. She estimated debits of $326,000. When you add and subtract all of that, that's why we're asking for $500,000 plus the $400,000, because it's $891,000, adding that some of that is repayments to the county. Schuster pointed out that with the money requested Monday, brings the total requested just in March to $1,255 million and $2.305 million year to date. The hospital's yearly budget is $4.5 million. And with May, September, typically low census numbers, not much revenue will be coming in. I don't know how to address this, Schuster said, adding that he would like to have a meeting with the hospital board, whose next board meeting is April 18th. County Attorney Frank Lacey asked if the hospital could take any cost-cutting measures, and Urita said that expenses are flat, but that's not enough gross revenue to support the low census. The question is, what are you doing to reduce the expenses because you can't increase the revenue? Urita responded that with no patients, you can send people home, but still have to pay them. And Schuster added that when they run out of paid time off, they're sent home without pay. We haven't run into that yet, but that is definitely something that can happen. Schuster and perhaps one other commissioner wants to meet with the hospital board. Schuster reiterated that the hospital has received $1.2 million in March, and we need to figure out what we're going to do to cut that between now and the end of the year. We need to discuss what's in the near future of the hospital and what the financial future for us and the county and the hospital. Schuster asked for a motion to approve the request for $900,000, and there was a 17-second pause without a motion, which is usually immediate. We have to have some sort of motion, Schuster said. The motion was made by Tom Chapman and seconded by Robert Gonzalez, passing 3-0 with Mickey Jack Perry absent. City Council renews City Secretary contract. Bashan Yorks. In a brief meeting Monday night, the City Council considered Secretary Marina Cantu's performance evaluation and pay, among other routine items. After 16 minutes, the council went into executive session to consider Cantu's performance, and after about 20 minutes, the council reconvened with their decision. For the evaluation that everybody submitted and we compiled together, it was basically that Nina does an outstanding job, said Mayor Chris Alexander. We basically have no complaints. She's rock solid, answers all our calls, emails, and questions in a timely manner, so we had a very high positive review of her. The council approved a salary of $80,000 per year. In other action, the council approved Resolution 23, appointing and setting the pay for election officials for the May 6th general election, in which a mayor and two city council members will be elected. The presiding judge will be Linda Blanco. Early voting ballot board judge will be Sandy Young. And the alternate judge and alternate early voting ballot board judge will be Abby Allen. The judges and clerks will be paid $14 an hour, up from $12 during the last election. A minimum of three clerks will be at each polling location. The council approved an agreement between the city and Mathis Bennett Pecos County 4-H scholarship auction scheduled for April 15th at the Pecos County Coliseum. The city will include 12 vehicles in the auction, ranging from a Chevrolet dump truck to an international truck tractor sanitation truck. Reuben Falcon made the motion to approve, saying he likes the fact that it benefits the 4-H members. Council awarded a bid for chemicals and filters for two water treatment plants to Alpha Water Resources. The city tabled awarding a bid for pest control services for city buildings.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 23rd. School board kicks around 4-day school week. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. Monahans Wicked Piute ISD District 4 School Board Trustee Steve Tuxhorn expressed concern about possible complications of implementing a 4-day school week for the coming 2023-2024 academic year during the Monday evening school board meeting. Quote, I have been doing some informal surveying on my own around the community, at restaurants, physical therapy, hospital. In the ones I talked to, 3 were maybes and 19 were no's. These are people scattered around the community. I'm not against the 4-day, but I think we are rushing into it. I think if we wanted to postpone it and look into it for the 2024-2025 school year, that would be prudent because there's a lot of wrinkles that need to be ironed out, Tuxhorn said. A survey was posted to each district school's Facebook, on the district Facebook, and a text on the school texting system, Remind. A staff survey was posted from February 7th and closed on February 16th. Approximately 309 responses were received. A student survey was posted on February 12th to February 22nd and received approximately 850 responses. The parent survey was posted to Facebook and Remind on February 7th and closed on February 22nd with approximately 750 responses. Quote, numerous articles I have read on student achievement are mostly inconclusive, but where they had the data, student achievement is down by about 2% each year, Tuxhorn said. We can't get certified teachers. We have aides having to teach classes. On Fridays, we have to herd a large number of students, maybe close to 100, into the gym to just sit while a couple of aides have to child-sit the group. So maybe a 4-day week would attract more teachers, MWP ISD Superintendent Chad Smith said. I don't think the lack of teachers has anything to do with a 5-day week. There's a nationwide teacher shortage. I think the teachers are just tired of the lack of respect, lack of parent support, and threat of violence, Tuxhorn said. The kindergarten kids are going to get out 30 minutes later, and to me, that's a concern. They will have to be kept until 4:05 instead of getting out at 2:30, Tuxhorn said. Yes, the days would have to be longer because we will have to make the Friday time up on the 4 days, Smith said. The student school year is reduced to minutes of required attendance, which is 75,600 minutes per student for the assigned school year. The sequence that the minutes are acquired is not specified, just the total amount needed per student. The high school and junior high students would be starting at 7:30 a.m. instead of 8 o'clock. The parents of the community need to have them there at 7:30 or they will be late. The kindergartners going until 4:05 makes an extremely long day for the little ones. I feel like it should all be discussed with the community and board, get some feedback, and then make an informed choice and not rush into making a decision now, Tuxhorn said. Also, on the staff survey, you asked what would be the advantage of a 4-day week. All the categories were less than 50% favored. Questions like, would attendance be improved? Only 45% agreed. Increase employee attendance, 46%. Increase staff morale, 40%. Less than 50% of the staff feels like it would make a large difference with the current issues, partly because 41% of the Fridays have teachers scheduled to work. Something else that has to be taken into the equation is time scheduling for the band and sports, who have practice scheduled early and late, Tuxhorn said. The band would practice on Fridays for a longer period of time, Smith said. There's a lot to be considered with a 4-day week. I think more money for the teachers would be a better solution to get and keep teachers. If we go to a 4-day week to try to attract teachers and more school districts go to a 4-day week, then we will be in the same place we are now while our students are put at a possible learning risk, Tuxhorn said. District 6 trustee Nancy Upchurch agreed with Tuxhorn about the long day for the kindergartners. It would be a really long day for the kindergarten kids, Upchurch said. First Baptist Church pastor Chris Powell was allowed 3 minutes to address the board with his own concerns about the proposed 4-day week for school. First, I want to say I love and support our school system, and I come here tonight only as an advocate for our students. I understand there are pros and cons to a 4-day school week. I have read both, the pros and the cons, and the advantages to both ways. But I want to share a few concerns I have about a 4-day calendar, and that has been shared with me by numerous people. I am only going to address 3 of the main concerns I have. I read a study from 2021 that said the 4-day week could shave off 1/6 of the usual gains a 5th grader would make in math. That would be equal to about 5 to 6 weeks of school. Over the years, those losses would multiply exponentially. If students are still behind because of COVID, we could be setting them up for long-term failure. Another study showed special interest groups of students, low income, special needs, and such, did not fare well with a 4-day week. We have a large population that fall inside that group of students. I also want to address the issue of child care, which is where a large majority of people have come to speak to me about. There could be many parents who could be adversely affected by the child care need for Fridays. There is not adequate child care in Monahans to absorb the influx of needed child care if Fridays are not a school day. There are many parents who could not pay for the child care even if it were available. The other thing is the long day for the young children many could be faced with a 12-hour day, Powell said. Another concern I have is how the Friday kids are going to eat. Some of the kids in the school system don't get much or anything to eat on weekends as it is, and a 4-day week will add another day to their missing meals. Teachers will be off, but the cafeterias will be open on Fridays. The cafeteria staff will be serving breakfast and lunch, Smith said. Texas has 27 school districts moving to the 4-day school week for the same reasons cited by Smith as the local school administration. 17 East Texas schools are following the trend, while North Texas has 15 on the bandwagon. The Texas Panhandle has 7 schools changing the calendar. South Texas has 1 and 2 in the Abilene area. West Texas would have 1 at this point, Monahans. These schools have in-class start times as early as 7:10 a.m. and dismissal times as late as 4:30 p.m. The Merkel Independent School District for 2022-2023 will take Mondays off. The Tioga Independent School District will have Mondays off with a day that is 28 minutes longer, and the school year will be 3 weeks longer. School Board Trustees, District 1, Steve Fine; District 2, School Board President, Raymond Reyes; District 3, Donna Garcia; District 5, Bobby Almanza; and District 7, Josh Schwarb, had no comments for or against the proposed changes. The school board will have the final say on the 4-day school week. Contrary to rumor, no election will be required. No action was taken by the board. Former Monahans coach, superintendent, dies at 84. Longtime Monahans coach, three-time MWP-ISD superintendent, and namesake of the Monahans High School Multipurpose Sports Complex, Jerry Larned, passed away on Saturday, March 18th in Abilene at the age of 84. Jerry was born March 25th, 1938 in Haskell to Joe and Florence Larned. He was the youngest of 4 children. He graduated from Haskell High School, where he participated in all sports. He played collegiate basketball at North Texas State in Denton. Jerry married Elizabeth Key from Throckmorton. They were married 60 years and dedicated their lives to education as teachers, principal, coach, and superintendent. Jerry spent time coaching at Bowie, Hamlin, Duncanville, Ira Ann, Solros State University, and spent many successful years in Monahans. He was named West Texas Coach of the Year in 1967, 1973, 1974, and 1976, and was South Plains Coach of the Year in 1974. Jerry served as director of the Texas High School Coaches Association and served as Master of Ceremonies for the Hall of Honor Luncheon at Coaching School for 13 years, where the state champion coaches are honored. He was voted into the Texas Panhandle Hall of Fame in 1982. Jerry received the Distinguished Service Award from the Texas High School Coaches Association in 1987. He was inducted into the Coaches Association Hall of Honor in 1992 and the Texas High School Football Hall of Fame in 2012. Jerry served as superintendent of the Monahan schools 3 different times and was twice named Region 18 Superintendent of the Year. He retired once to run the Kent Companies in Midland for former player Bill Kent. The Monahan School Board lured him back for another 4 years. He retired again, but not one to sit still. He coached at New Mexico Military Institute, served as interim superintendent in Kermit, Bernie, and again in Monahans. He was honored in 2003 by having the multi-sport athletic facility renamed the Jerry Larned Sports Complex in Monahans. In 2004, Jerry was hired as athletic director at McMurray University. After 3 years, Jerry retired again, but continued to work for the Kent Companies. Known as the Old Coach, Jerry was a sought-after speaker for sports clinics, sports banquets, business conventions, educational meetings, and as an after-dinner speaker. Jerry always found time to work in his church and community. He served as chairman of the Methodist Administrative Board, was president of the Monahans Chamber of Commerce, president of the Rotary Club, chairman of the Ward County Appraisal District, economic development consultant, and in 1985 was voted outstanding citizen in Monahans. With the many honors and awards Jerry received, he was always modest in his acceptance. He preferred to pass off most of the praise to his players, assistant coaches, and teachers. Jerry is preceded in death by his parents, Joe and Florence Larned, brothers Kenneth and Joe Larned Jr., sister Alta Faye Harvey, son Todd Dean Larned, and daughter Pam. He is survived by his wife Beth, chosen grandson Buck Kent, nieces, nephews, and special sons and daughters. A celebration of life was held Tuesday, March 21st, at Aldersgate Methodist Church in Abilene. A private burial was held earlier in the day in Haskell. Arrangements are under the direction of Pearsall Funeral Directors in Abilene. Condolences may be offered to the family online at www.pbfuneralsdirectors.com. If you wish, donations may be made in honor of Jerry to either of the following organizations: Bronze Lobo Statue Project, care of First Baptist Church, 504 South Alice Avenue, Monahans, Texas, 79756. Aldersgate Methodist Church, New Hymnal Fund, 1741 Sales Boulevard, Abilene, Texas, 79605. Or to Hendrick Hospice Care, 1651 Pine Street, Post Office Box 1922, Abilene, Texas, 79601. MEDC halts paying Mesa's $37,000 bill for Basin Sidewalk Project. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Meeting in regular session on Monday, the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, the MEDC board members, acknowledged a report from Andrew Mellon with Maverick Engineering, who oversees all of MEDC's projects, on the Basin Sidewalk Project, which was completed by Daniel Mesa's concrete company. Last August, the board approved a bid from Daniel Mesa to construct a sidewalk around the detention pond near the new school on 12th Street and East Monahans Parkway. Mesa's bid came in at $35,500. The only other bid submitted was from Rubio's Paving, which totaled $54,000. The report stated there is 265 liner feet of sidewalk showing signs of imminent failure after 4 months and is cracking from improper construction practices. This cracking is caused by improper curing practices and/or design, or a mix that was too dry, the report read. The report goes on to read, a section of the sidewalk will need to be removed around the fire hydrant on Monahans Parkway near the school due to ADA regulations. During forming, Maverick informed Mr. Mesa and his crew that the sidewalk around the hydrant needed to be centered and reformed before pouring. This was not remedied by the contractor. In all, 284 feet of sidewalk and drive entry will need to be replaced. MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said, the cracking on 12th Street was pretty severe, and even though Maverick was overseeing the project, they wouldn't give adequate time for Maverick to get from Midland to Monahans before they began to pour concrete. The board acknowledged the report from Maverick Engineering. The next agenda item was also related to Mesa and was to approve an invoice submitted by Angelica Mesa on February 28th on behalf of Daniel Mesa in the amount of $37,296, even though the original bid was for $35,526. When the project was completed, the city offices were closed for the holiday, and when Mesa asked for a check, I told them city offices were closed, therefore no check could be made, and also we did not have an invoice at the time, Adalto said. Adalto added the first invoice on the project received was the one submitted on February 28th, which was delivered by certified mail. Overseers of the project, Maverick Engineering, suggested the board pay Mesa $16,593 of the total invoice. The $16,593 is the amount minus the cost of the repairs to the 284 feet of sidewalk, which will have to be replaced, Adalto said. In a letter from Mellon to MEDC Director Ashley Adalto, dated March 9th, Mellon states Mesa calculated the bid incorrectly, and the actual total of the bid is $36,426, and Odessa Fence actually installed the chain-link gates. Therefore, making those changes would bring the bill down to $26,076. Mesa later submitted a change order to Adalto to change the sidewalk from 5 feet to 4 feet, which was approved, bringing the adjusted bid total to $22,739, the letter read. However, the final invoice from Mesa still reflected the $9,350 for the chain link gates and a $5,170 charge that stated the engineer provided the wrong elevations for ramp, which added 2 days to project for work to be torn out and reformed. In the letter, Mellor said an itemized changed order was not submitted to Maverick to review, accept, or deny for reforming the drive, and based on the amount charged, it is estimated Mesa is charging $116.75 per person per hour, with $500 for a bobcat and water for the day on a job which only took 9 hours and included a one-hour lunch break taken by Mesa and four crew members. The letter concludes with Mellon stating the list of items which need to be replaced in order for the project to be considered completed and shows the adjusted maximum total payable to Mesa of $16,593 if he is not able to complete all replacement work. Member Hal Upchurch asked, "Does this account for what we're paying Maverick Engineering to tell us this? I think we need to deduct what we're paying Maverick from the $16,593. The bill from Maverick Engineering to MEDC for the Basin Sidewalk Site Observation and Project Summary Report totaled $9,000. Maverick was supposed to be on top of the job. When we approved the bid, Andrew stood right in this room and assured the board they would oversee the project and make sure it was done right," Board President Richard Irwin added. Member Leticia Rodriguez said, "Maverick should negotiate the fee down and not charge MEDC for the whole amount because ultimately the project was their responsibility." Member Marilena Sines said, "I don't feel comfortable cutting Mesa's check when we don't have proof Mesa didn't do what they were required to do by Maverick Engineering." Adalto told the board there was a communication paper trail from Mullen to Mesa voicing his concerns with the project while it was ongoing, but Mesa never responded. Mayor Adam Steen said, "The way I see it is Maverick continued to let it happen by not halting the job and stating how it would be done for there on out." Upchurch suggested sending a letter to Mesa requesting her at next month's meeting, along with Maverick, to get the confusion resolved and for both to bring their documentation. The approval of the invoice was tabled. In other business, the board heard an update from Carol Faulkner with Faulkner Consulting concerning the broadband project. In the next few days, the company selected as the internet services provider, Hosted America, will have a website for customers to sign up for services with no deposit required, Faulkner said. Construction on the conduit and handholds is finishing up, and fiber installation began a few weeks ago. Fiber installation should move really fast, and once it is in place, the next step is getting the guts of the system hooked up, he added. The head end center for the fiber will be located on a small piece of land located on the access road of Interstate 20 near the Ward County Event Center, inside a small building donated by the city. Faulkner also told the board A thank you party is slated for mid-April for the donors of the broadband project. In other actions, there was a short presentation on the outdoor fitness court, for which the city is currently applying for a grant through the National Fitness Campaign and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas. Board members watched a video presentation which explained the idea behind the fitness court, which features 7 functional training zones: core, squat, push, lunge, pull, agility, and bend, as well as thousands of bodyweight exercises and digital programming for adults of all ages and abilities. Council members gave their seal of approval for the city to apply for a grant during their meeting last Tuesday and agreed to the potential location on 15th Street beside the detention pond and directly across the street from Car Wash 828. City Manager Rex Thee explained part of the grant process was community interest and showing the interest of the council, chamber, and MEDC would offer a better chance of getting the full-sized grant. MEDC board members had some of the same questions as city council members did, such as, was the selected location big enough, and where liability falls, since MEDC currently owns the 0.54-acre property. Thee said the property would need to be transferred into the city's name if the grant was secured, therefore it can be covered in the insurance under Parks and Recreation. The grants are from $35,000 to $50,000, with the total cost of the fitness court ranging from $130,000 to $175,000. The remaining balance to build the 76 by 76 fitness court would be funded by private funds and any available funds in the upcoming city budget. I think the city can find anywhere between $85,000 to $105,000, which includes the concrete slab, within the parks budget for the project. Board member Hal Upchurch said, "It seems like a good project and will make good use of property we can't give away." The board approved their interest in the project. In final actions, the board tabled approving bids for Monahans Parkway flume revision because only one bid was received on the project, which was not complete. This is the only bid received, even though I sent it out to companies who have bid before. No one responded, MEDC Director Ashley Adaltus said. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, Leticia Rodriguez, and Mary Elena Sines, and Kathy Anthony. Ward County Sheriff's Office jail sergeant arrested Tuesday. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. In a prepared statement to the news, Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said, "Ward County Sheriff's Office, WCSO, administrative supervisory personnel were made aware of alleged criminal conduct concerning an employee within the Ward County Jail facility. Based on the investigation, Ward County Jailer Sergeant Ruben Rodriguez was arrested on a charge of official oppression, a Class A misdemeanor. Official oppression is defined as a public servant who uses their office to deny someone their rights, sexually harass, or mistreat someone. WCSO requested the Texas Rangers Division of the Texas Department of Public Safety investigate the allegation," Valle said. The investigation was turned over to the Texas Rangers. Further information and questions should be directed to Texas Department of Public Safety Public Information Officers at 432-498-2100, he added. Rodriguez's bond was set at $3,000, and he was released after posting the bond. Sergeant Stephen Blanco, Texas DPS Media Communications, confirmed Rodriguez's arrest to the news and said, "This is an ongoing investigation by the Texas Rangers." It was not clear as of press time if Rodriguez could face additional charges. The story will be updated as information becomes available. Jackson takes plea for 8 years in TDCJ. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Thorntonville man who was arrested last August after Ward County Sheriff's deputies found methamphetamines in his car and his home has accepted a plea agreement and was ordered to serve 8 years confinement in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Carl Wayne Jackson, age 47, of 2307 West 3rd Street, appeared in front of 143rd Judicial Judge Mike Swanson on March 14th, pleading guilty and accepting responsibility to a charge of possession of controlled substance, penalty group 1, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, a second-degree felony. The arrest came after Ward County Sheriff's Office deputies conducted a traffic stop in the 800 block of West 2nd Street on a black sport utility vehicle Jackson was driving on August 12th around 12:30 a.m. Jackson was arrested for an outstanding warrant for a charge of manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, more than 1 gram, less than 4 grams, a second-degree felony from a previous investigation. During the traffic stop, sheriff's deputies conducted a search of Jackson's vehicle and found over 27 grams of suspected meth inside his vehicle. A search warrant was later executed at Jackson's home in Thorntonville, where deputies located a stolen firearm and more suspected methamphetamine packaged to sell. In all, Jackson had charges of 2 counts of possession less than 1 gram, more than 4 grams, 1 count of possession less than 1 gram, manufacturing, delivering of a controlled substance less than 1 gram, more than 4 grams, theft of firearm, and was also charged with abandoning or endangering a child, a state jail felony, because at the time the search warrant was executed, a child under 15 years of age was in the home. According to District Attorney Randall Reynolds, as part of the plea agreement, all charges were dismissed except the possession of controlled substance penalty group 1, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, a second-degree felony, because Jackson accepted responsibility. Jackson has remained in custody at the Ward County Jail on a $45,000 bond. Along with the 8-year prison sentence, Jackson was ordered to pay court costs of $393, restitution of $180, and was given credit for 214 days time served. Reynolds served as attorney for the state on the case, with Alan Nicholas as assistant district attorney.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.